I'm Dolly and I'm an alcoholic. And I live in Australia, on the East Coast, which is a beautiful area. And tonight I'm going to share my experience, strength and hope, and hope that somebody gets something out of where I've been, what I've done and where I'm going. My drinking story started in a little town called Crindy Beach when I was only a teenager. And I remember the night as clear as it was yesterday. My sister and a young boy who lived two doors up had stolen port from my father's flagon and from other people's flagons. The two houses used to drink together regularly. And so they had managed to put aside quite a quantity of port by pinching bits here and there. And they put it in a Coke bottle, and the three of us were going to have a drink. And what I didn't know was that they were only pretending to drink. And so I was taking big mouthfuls and they were pretending and just putting it up to their mouth. And what I remember of the rest of that night is that I had been eating grapes during the day. We had a lot of grapes growing around the area. And by the end of the night, the grapes were coming out of me from all angles. I was so sick and I couldn't walk. I had to crawl the two houses down the street to our house, and my sister had to sneak me in the bedroom that my mother wouldn't know. And that was the introduction to my drinking, drunk the very first time and blackout. The next time that it was really bad, and I know there was other little drinks in between, we're of that era where Dad would give you the little bit in the bottom of the glass, or a taste of this or a taste of that, or you'd pinch little bits and pieces that were left in people's glasses. But the next time was I was drinking with my sister. She had by now left home, and she got me on scotch. And I was supposed to perform in a school play that night, and I was 15, I remember it very clearly, and I was too drunk to go out on the stage. The teachers were disgusted, the other students, although I thought they were disgusted, but I've spoke to some of them since and none of them really thought that I did anything so bad. I think a lot of them knew that I had a drinking problem early in school. I didn't go to formals. I turned up and then snuck out and went to pubs with girls that had already left school or with my sister. So that path was well and truly being travelled before I left school. When I turned 16, I left the little country town and moved to Sydney, which was amazing because I was the most introverted one of me and my two sisters. And I got into trouble almost straight away. I started getting around with the Finks, which is a motorbike gang, who knocked me around and swapped me around and screwed me around, basically. For a little country girl, that was pretty bad. I only lasted a couple of years in the city and ended up going up to the Blue Mountains, where I got a position in a hotel as a barmaid before I actually turned 18, and I didn't tell my boss that until long after. One of the drinking bouts that I remember very early, and by this stage I still wasn't even 20, and I remember a lot of us had drank through the night, and we were going to go down Echo Point, the Thousand Stairs, and at daylight. And come daylight, all I wanted to do was keep drinking, and so did Harry, one of the guys with us. And so we sat there and strained brown musket through a doily because there was ants in it, but we still wanted to drink it. So rather than do what other teenagers were doing and going for a walk out in to the mountains, we were sitting at home drinking strained brown musket. Not long after that, I ended up in Parramatta Psychiatric Centre. I spent a Christmas there, and that was a terrifying ordeal, absolutely terrifying. But it didn't stop there. I was to have a couple more institutionalisations as time went on, in Lismore and in Coffs Harbour. And if any of you have been institutionalised, you know it's a horrifying ordeal, especially for a young woman. Well, I felt like I've said a lot in a very short time, and I don't know if I'm talking really fast or it's that I haven't said a lot of this for a while. I try to mix my story up when I do share at meetings so that I don't become complacent and boring to people who are listening. I know what that was like when I first came into AA, I remember a lot of people would walk out when a certain woman shared that was their coffee break time or their smoke break. And it was because her story sounded so repetitive. And I remember thinking way back then, oh my God, I hope I never do that. So I obviously knew somewhere deep inside me I'd stick around for a while, but I didn't want to be the person that made everyone get up and walk out. On that note, something else I learned in those very early months was to do with the fourth step. There was a rehab in the town where I got sober, and a lot of the people that relapsed, what I put together very quickly was when they were doing their fourth step. And in this rehab, it was a 6-week program, and they had to have finished the 12 steps by the time they were released. And so I made up my mind very early that I wouldn't touch the fourth step until I was at least a year sober. So I was giving myself a year. I believed that I would get to a year sober. That never, it never entered my head that I wouldn't. But long before I got to that stage, there was many, many, many horrifying incidences that took place before I walked into the rooms of AA. I left Katoomba for many years and then went back there, and ironically that was where I got sober, where I did some of my most damaging drinking. But I went back to Coffs Harbour area where I'd come from, and while back up there, still as a young woman, I married twice. My first husband did horrendous things to me, including tipping petrol over me and trying to set me on fire while I was asleep, and it was only that other people smelt the petrol and got into the room and got the match off him as he was about to throw it on the bed. That matter is going through court today, many, many years later. And that's something I haven't mentioned for a long time either. So this is really bringing up a lot of things for me, because I'm trying to do a summary of my drinking, then recovering life. That went on to me getting married again later on after divorcing him, and that husband was to commit suicide when he was drinking one night, and he did that in front of me when I was 8 months pregnant. Rather than stop me drinking, that increased it rapidly. But even before that happened, at the age of 27, I was living in Woolgoolga, and my father and I, our birthdays were 2 days apart. And if you've ever been around Woolgoolga, just mention the name Pegleg, and everyone knew him, everyone. And I was Pegleg's daughter. And we had been drinking for many, many, many days. And he had a big V8 car, Valiant, and he had it parked in my driveway, and he was going to go home. And I said, "You're too drunk to reverse the car out of the drive." Now, having said that, I couldn't drive at all, and I was as drunk, if not drunker, than him. And I said I would reverse it for him, which I attempted to do. But the car, I'm a little woman, it was a big car, and I was very drunk, and I didn't know how to drive. I hit the accelerator and the reverse, and the car went airborne, and I went through the house across the road. There was not even a mark on the road that separated the two houses. I squashed the baby's cot in the car that I was in, and the bed, the double bed the parents slept in, ended up against the wall, and the parents were on the ground praying when I stepped out of the car. Some of these memories are memories that I wish were blackout, because it's taken a long time to come to terms with that night. I by the time I got to court, and a lot happened in between that time, my father took the blame, then they found out it was me, and on it went. But I gave myself up to the police, and the baby, thankfully, wasn't in the cot. The relatives that were staying in the house, they were all pretty sick of my partying, and they had taken the baby in the early hours of the morning out to one of the other bedrooms, because it had been crying for days and days and days because of the noise coming from across the street. The judge said to me that I was a very lucky woman, that I wasn't there on worse charges, and he threw the book at me anyway. So in a matter of only a very few short years, I was almost murdered. I almost killed a baby, and my husband did kill himself. And I kept drinking, and I drank, and I drank, and I drank. And my life became one of shame, guilt, remorse, and alcoholism. I moved town. I went down to Wagga, which was as far away as I could get from all of these things, because I felt totally shamed. And I had a newborn baby who also almost died. They hospital in the chapel in the hospital. She was born 5 weeks after Peter died. And so the years went on and my drinking continued until in the end I called DOCS, the Department of Community Services, and I said, I'm self-destructing, I'm hurting my children, I need you to step in. And they came to see me and they told me what a brave woman I was to call them on myself. And I felt anything but brave. Well, this is really stirring up some emotion, guys. And time went on and I moved back to the Blue Mountains. And I got very involved with church again, and I hadn't done that for a long time. I'd been in and out of churches but couldn't stay for any great length of time because I didn't feel worthy. I felt that I'd let God down. I felt that I'd let myself down and everybody that I cared for. But I started going to church again, and it was hard. I had to walk past this church that I ended up joining, and I had to walk past it. Well, I had to walk past an RSL club to get to the church, and many a time I didn't make it, or many a time I didn't make it home from church because of the club, and I would send the kids on home, or I'd get the other adults that were with us to take the kids on home. I couldn't do it. I could not do it. And it wasn't until I was working with a youth group and I let them down. I let them down. I made a total fool of myself, and I turned up one night and told them all at a function that I was running that I turned up drunk. I hadn't drank for a while, but I hadn't been to AA. And I had a choice. I could go home to my new husband or I could go to the pub, and I didn't like my new husband. I married him for respectability and for all the wrong reasons, and found out that he wasn't a very good man. And I sat in the top pub in Katoomba for half an hour nursing a schooner, and I never bought schooners. I always bought middies because I have small hands and I couldn't hold a schooner glass properly. And I sat for half an hour crying over this schooner because I didn't want to drink, but I didn't want the alternative either. And so I ended up getting drunk and turning up at this function where I was supposed to be with all these youth. And the next day I rang a pastor that I knew quite well who'd been a miner before he was a pastor, and he'd been a heavy drinker and he understood the nature of the beast. And I rang him and I said, I can't do what I'm supposed to do tomorrow with the youth because I've just shamed myself. And he said, what have you done? I told him, and he said, do you want me to come around? And I said, no, I'm on a bender. There's no point. I will keep drinking now for a time. And it was about a week later when I finally contacted him and asked him to come. And when he did, he asked me, was there any grog left in the fridge? And I said, there's a six-pack. And he said, if you're really serious, he said, tip it out. So I tipped it down the sink. And that night a friend came, and I didn't even know what AA meant. I had no idea. And a friend came around and he said, why don't you go to one of these AA meetings? I will come with you. Oh, okay, we'll go to one of these. So off we went, and I sat in the front row, and there was a man called John, and he was in his 80s then, and he was 40-something years sober. And he swore and he slammed his hand on the desk, and I jumped every time he did, and I was terrified and my hands were sweating. And early in that week, I was asked to share, and I went out the front and I tried to stand up and I couldn't. My legs wouldn't hold me. And from that moment on, I never stood up when I shared. I've always sat down. For many years, I had people have a go at me and tell me, you are supposed to stand behind the chairs. And I couldn't. I sat in the chairs. And in the end, common sense told me, well, what the bloody hell? What are the chairs there for if not for sitting on? And so I sat on the chairs and I sat on the chairs and I sat on the chairs, and I'm still sitting on the chairs. And not because I'm so nervous anymore, but because I'm comfortable sitting on the chairs. And for 6 weeks I sat on those chairs, and for 6 weeks I kept thinking about that six-pack. I thought about drinking it, I thought about the smell of it. Every time somebody mentioned beer, I could smell it, taste it, and I missed it. And eventually it got the better of me, and the same man was still taking me to meetings. And I said to him one night, drink with me. And he said no. And he argued and argued with me. And, I mean, argued for a long time. He even pulled up in front of everyone standing outside the hall and tried to make a fool of me so that I'd get out of the car and go into the meeting, and I still wouldn't. And I said to him, if you don't drink with me, I will find someone who will. And so I drank for another 3 months, and I drank chaotically, absolutely chaotically. It was like everything in me knew this was the last big bender, and it was. I drank day and night around the clock. I just got my fill, and I started telling people that as of the 10th of January, I would never drink again. And that date meant nothing, absolutely nothing. It does now. On January the 10th, just gone, I was 18 years sober, but it meant nothing at the time. It was just a number I plucked out of the air. And on the morning of the 10th of January, I woke up on the floor with other people. There was pot. I got up and I showered, and that night I went back to the very same meeting that was the one that I'd been to originally, and have been going continually since. So, yeah, by now I was back in meetings. And before that, I'm going to tell you just a story. I share this story oftentimes when I'm at a rehab meeting, because the guys need a laugh. You know, there's some big rehabs around here, and a lot of them are men's rehabs, and these boys are scared, and they're Koori meeting, they're Koori rehabs, and you only have to look at the faces, and these boys are scared, and they hear all this really serious stuff. So if and when I go to rehab meetings, I share this story just to break it up a little bit for them. But there was one day before I stopped drinking, and I was so sick. And I was laying in bed, and many of you will relate to this, so the doona therapy, as we call it. I was down under the doona, and I didn't want the world to see me, and I didn't want to see the world. And I was so sick and dehydrated. The dehydration was incredible, and I just wanted to drink every fluid I could get my hands on. And my little fella, Brendan, came in, and he said, Mummy, do you want anything? And I said, yeah, can you get Mummy a drink of water? So he did. Off he went, and he came back as proud as punch, because he was only a little fella. And he gave me the drink of water, and I upended it and drank every mouthful as quick as I could. And then the penny dropped, and I thought, wait a minute, Brennan can't reach the tap. And I called him back, and I said, Bren, where did you get Mummy's water? And he said, out of the toilet. So I had just drank toilet water, and that showed me how low you can go. I usually get a better response than this, but anyway. So time went on, and this is the second time now. This is after the 3 months, and getting dry. And I went to an NA meeting in Katoomba, because there was no AA meeting that night, and I needed a meeting desperately. And I was sitting in this meeting, and it was a very, very big meeting, because it was a rehab meeting. And all the women that had been asked to share had shared. I was looking for a loophole. There was no two ways about it. I was looking for a loophole. And one woman had shared that she had prostituted herself, another that she had stuck needles in her arms, and yet another that she had lost children to docs. And my mind grabbed all three of those things and said, I never stuck a needle in my arm, I never lost my children to docs, and I never prostituted myself. It took me a long time to realise, however, that I was no different. I was no different to any one of these girls. I had given it away rather than have enough sense to sell it. I was emotionally, spiritually, and mentally absent from my children. And I was a basket case on alcohol. I was an alcoholic. So what was the difference whether it went into me via a needle being a drug or down my throat being alcohol? And it took a little while for that awakening. But I was all ready to do the bolt. I was going. They were my outs, and I was just about to stand up, and they asked a guy called Dave to share. And this big man who was sitting beside me, and I hadn't noticed him before, stood up, and he was in full leathers. He had a massive beard, and he said, "My name's Dave, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm 12 years sober." And I thought, oh, okay. And he started telling my story from a male point of view. And I sat and I listened, and that man saved my life that night. After the meeting, he said, "You were about to go, weren't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Here's my number, you'll need it." I mean, there was more conversation, but that was the gist of it. And it only took a couple of days, Sunday, and I needed that number. I was so sick. I was beside myself. I reached out and I rang. And he was a part of the Fifth Chapter Motorcycle Sobriety Group, and they were having a barbecue at his place that day, and he ended up on the phone with me most of the afternoon while his wife entertained the visitors, and Dave became my friend, my ally, my support. He took me to meetings everywhere, him and the boys on the bikes, and within a year of my first, within the first year of my sobriety, my son, the same little one that gave me the toilet water, was in a hit and run car accident and hospitalised for 6 weeks on the bottom of the mountain. And I lived on the top of the mountain, was a single mum with two kids by this stage. And guys would go and sit with Brandon in the hospital while I went to check on the children up the top of the mountain, or so that I could go to a home group, or they'd take me to local meetings. They did so much for my family, so, so much, and I was ever grateful for them. Then many years later, I was actually at the funeral of one of them, and one of the other ones came up and he said, "I knew you would make it." And I was 7 years sober at that stage, and I thought, my goodness, you know, I didn't think I'd make it, but you thought I'd make it. And that meant so much to me. And I've been to so many funerals, so, so many funerals. And somebody told me that very early in my recovery, that if I was around long enough, I'd go to a lot of funerals. And that was one prediction I would have wished hadn't come true, but it has. We lost two lovely men last year, close here, both to suicide. And a lot of these guys shouldn't have died when they didn't, a lot of the guys on the bikes. And it's heartbreaking. Then I ran into Wayne, was one of the ones that used to sit with Brendan a lot, and he gave him a little card, like a business card, and on it it said, "I owe you one bike ride." And when I seen him at Big John's funeral, he came up to me and he said, "I still owe your young fella a ride on my bike." And I said, yeah. And so away I went, and we were going to keep in touch and all that sort of thing. And then a couple of years later, I was at a meeting. I'd come back to the Central Coast, and I was living on the Central Coast, and I was at a meeting, and I was sharing this very story about, you know, Brennan being in hospital and everything, and I seen looks on people's faces, and I knew something was up, and I didn't know what. And a woman called me aside after the meeting. She said, "I think I better talk to you." She said, "We buried Wayne last week." And it was such a shock. And so the following Friday, I was at a meeting and I was sharing about that and what a shock it was to me and how painful. And somebody said to me, "Dolly, that's Wayne's father sitting over there." I thought, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. So John came up to me after the meeting and he said, one day when I'm up to it, I'd like you to tell me some of your Wayne stories. And that was lovely. The one thing you can rely on in this fellowship is you will go to a lot of funerals, and ones that maybe we shouldn't have been going to. So not the Christmas just gone. The Christmas before that, I finally went home to my hometown that I had run away from so long ago. I hadn't been home for 17 years. And Dave now and Wendy, his wife, are living up in the little town that I came from. And I spent the afternoon with them and then went to meeting with Dave. And I got to thank Wendy, and I shared this only yesterday in a meeting. I got to thank Wendy, because had she not allowed Dave to take me to these meetings. Had she not allowed me to sit on the back of his motorbike, I was 35 years old. I had no morals. I had no sense. I didn't have much going at all at that time. And I said, why did you do that? And she said, because I trusted you. And she will never know, you know, what that one little sentence meant to me. The same as when Mark said, I knew you'd make it. There's a few pivotal sentences that you'll hear throughout your life that define you and what people think of you. And they were two of those sentences that defined me. This woman trusted me, and I never betrayed that trust. Never. In the 18 years that I've known them now, I've never ever betrayed that trust. And I had a lovely afternoon with them, and then Dave and I went to the meeting and were able to share about our story. And then, ironically, I give a talk up at the local hospital to outpatients of a Monday, it was once a month, now it's every second Monday, and I was sharing this story about Dave last Monday. And after we were finished, a woman said to me, I was in Woolgoolga 4 months ago, and Dave was in the chair, and he gave me his number. So 18 years later, Dave's still doing as Dave does, and this woman validated a story that I just told to everybody, and it was such a blessing. It was so ironic and so humbling at the same time. I have lost a lot in my sobriety, as some people do. I had two breakdowns. We hear a lot, and I don't know if this is a platform to say, but it's part of my story. We shouldn't take antidepressants. We shouldn't do this. We shouldn't do that. And it's very controversial here in Newcastle at the moment. But for many, many years of my sobriety, I refused to take them. And had I taken them when the doctor prescribed them and tried to talk me into it, I may not have had the breakdowns that I had. Today, it's sort of a dichotomy. I'm glad, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but I'm glad that I had the breakdowns. I didn't know who I was anymore. I had always been my parents' daughter. I'd always been my children's mother, and somewhere I had got lost. I didn't know who I was. And from that, this woman has forged in the last 4 or 5 years, and I find that she's a much better woman than she ever was in any other part of her recovery, and it's me. And there's a lot of aspects about yourself when you have to recreate yourself that it's even better than being given a second chance. You get to find out what makeup you really like, not just the makeup that you think you like, and what clothes you really like. And you don't have to wear high heels if you don't want to. You can wear hippie shoes, and you can do what you like, because you're defining yourself. You're not defining anybody else. And that's been a part that I've really loved. This has been the biggest talk I've had for a long time. gosh. I didn't think I'd end up speechless, but I've said a lot to a lot of strangers tonight that I haven't said for a long, long time. In a sense, a lot of mothers, especially, in a sense, a lot of fathers lose their children through alcoholism, and I hear a lot of men say that they got their children back when they got sober, and I know that. That can be hard for a lot of women, because they're the ones that have done the hard yards. They're the ones that have done the parenting and all the rest. But for me, I lost mine more in sobriety. My oldest son would have preferred I had kept drinking. There was all sorts of things, and most importantly was my breakdowns. I had been indestructible, infallible. Alcoholism didn't break me. But here I was suddenly crying and sad and depressed and all these other things. And so I do a lot more for others today. I'm very involved in service. I'm very involved with homeless people. I'm very involved with young people. I like being of service. I think that's the purpose of us being here. I think that's the meaning of life, to be of service to one another. I heard a beautiful saying, and I hate this saying, I'll finish on this, but I will finish on this. I heard this wonderful thing once, and I think it's where I'm at in my life, and it is that when I meet my maker, he won't ask me how long I was sober. He'll ask me what I did with the gift of sobriety that he gave me. So I hope that I have a good answer for him, and I think the way I'm going, I will have. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I feel totally humbled at having been able to do this. Thank you.